Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. This evening is Thursday, October 20th, 2011. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, filmmaker Jamie Johnson on Engaging America in a Real Conversation. Jamie has produced two documentaries, which are our selection in Let's Go to the Movies this evening. The first is Born Rich, about growing up wealthy in America, and the second is 1%, The 1%, which explores the rationale that enables 1% of Americans to control nearly half the wealth of the country. If you haven't watched them, I strongly, strongly recommend them. Just in the pre-discussion with Jamie, I was telling him one of my goals this evening is to get you to watch these documentaries. I think they're very extraordinary and very special. In addition to being very entertaining, they ask a lot of probing questions, and they ask them in a very human way about the consolidation of power and wealth in America. And there are themes which come out of that emerge from those sort of different questions and answers and conversations in both of the documentaries that I think are very, very important for not just our culture in America, but globally. And that is questions we've been talking about a lot here. One is, do we want an economy in which we make money from innovation or political privilege? Do we want an economy where we make money from helping each other or from harming each other? Do we want an economy where we make money from harming the earth or from being a good steward? And we've enjoyed a financial bubble that's come primarily from government debt, and it's financed a great deal of privilege and unproductive behavior, not just among the wealthy or any particular class, but across our society. And as deficits explode, that's not likely to continue. So it means it's a good time to start talking about how our money works. And as Jamie's films have demonstrated, talking about money makes us uncomfortable, but it's something that is important and we can learn a lot from. So again, I encourage you to watch them. We'll be talking about them tonight. Our theme tonight is Welcome to the Paradigm Shift. It's a title in one of the posters from Occupy Wall Street, Welcome to the Paradigm Shift. And what we're seeing, and you're seeing it also come out of the demonstrations, is a shift in consciousness from a world in which we try to understand and predict what in the world is going on to one where we share responsibility to invent what goes on. I'm in California now, but I was driving from Pennsylvania to Tennessee several weeks ago and listening to interviews with John Trudell, who's a poet and musician, and he told the story of Pandora's Box, which I'm sure I heard when I was young, but I haven't heard for many years. And he said, Pandora opened the box, and out came seven evils, and then out came hope to help us deal with the evil. And he said, in some respects, hope may be the greatest evil because it stops us from appreciating what we have in the now and working with that to make something happen now. The idea was that hope was given to us to help us deal with the evil, but in fact he says, no, let's give up on hope and start working with what we have in the now. And I thought that was sort of great advice for the paradigm shift. Money and markets. Gaddafi is now confirmed dead, which proves, if anything, that if all the money on the planet wants you dead, it's simply a matter of time. Too many people can make too much money helping you get dead. NATO has announced that it's going to meet on Friday to decide whether or not to stop the bombing. That's expected. We've now seen about a $1 billion bombing program inundate Libya. It's achieved a number of things. First, it's driven the Chinese out. Go back and listen to Jim Norman's wonderful interview on the oil card, and that's part of what the Libya issue is about, as to who's going to harvest the rich resources in Africa. It ensures the flow of oil back to Europe, and it ensures that the rich resources of the Western powers, or Libya's rich resources, will be available to the Western powers. The bombing has done tremendous damage to Libya. This was a country, it's not only one of the richest countries in Africa, but it enjoyed a very high quality of life. It's expected that a lot of the things Gaddafi was responsible for are going to change, one being he encouraged a lot of local circulation of capital within Africa. In addition, very high subsidies of the local population from the oil wealth of the country. Interestingly enough, as the son of an African, President Obama is certainly a smart political choice to lead the growth of the American military presence and influence into Africa. as America and Europe compete with the Chinese for the oil, minerals, water, and agricultural resources. Libya was one of the countries that held out of the sort of central banking system. Iran and North Korea are also two, which proves the point that if you're going to resist supporting the dollar reserve game, it's best to have nuclear weapons. The markets continued to go sideways this week with gold and silver down on the news from Libya. That's not surprising. The more resources available for the slow burn is usually depressing on the precious metals markets. There's an outpouring of stories. I noted them last week. It's happening again this week on the size of the student loan market, indicating trouble brewing in that market, particularly as unemployment rises and the economy continues to be slow. We saw mortgage rates continue at 4% this week. The administration is trying another proposal to allow creditworthy homeowners to refinance underwater mortgages. That's a very important election issue. The last efforts haven't worked, but the government is now negotiating with major banks over both the foreclosures and the refinancing programs. If that goes through, California will be a major beneficiary. It leads the nation with 2.1 million mortgages in which homeowners are underwater and can't refinance. A very interesting interview this week and last week with Jim Rickards, who talked about the banks being the new China. What he says is, as we continue to watch the financial bailouts, the banks, both in Europe and the United States, increasingly put in a regulatory vise. It makes it possible for the governments to require the banks to basically replace China in the treasury market. Be interesting to see what's going on with the pension funds. Of course, the pension funds still own a lot more than China, Saudi, and a lot of the foreign buyers. But what he's saying is the slow burn can continue because the banks will balloon their balance sheets with treasury. So they'll be forced to raise deposits and they'll lend them long to the government. And that's going to keep propping the dollar for a long time to come. I agree with Rickards. I think it's a very astute comment. It underscores the importance of circulating capital to each other without going through the system or being forced to go through the system. In that vein, I would note a report from Louisiana up on the blog that they're trying to outlaw the use of cash in secondhand transactions now because cash is legal tender. I'm not sure how you can do that under the Constitution, but it does make you sit back and say, An excellent question came in from Dallas. Catherine, what are your sources in D.C. saying about the direction the Super Committee is taking? My congressman, who is co-chairman, refuses to say anything. It's a good question. I don't know the answer. I continue to watch, and I haven't seen anything that struck me as particularly meaningful. What a Super Committee means is that provisions which are important can suddenly get instituted. Change can get instituted very quickly with little notice. But as of yet, we haven't seen that, so we just have to watch. I did put up on the blog another comment about just saying no to a constitutional convention. You see more and more continued things circulating on the Internet proposing constitutional amendments and conventions, and I warn you. And, of course, things like the Super Committee make me nervous when those kinds of changes are coming afoot. It's been a slow news week, so I'm going to cut the news off faster than expected and go to the interview because there's an awful lot to talk about. I have, as you know, my hero. I have a hero once a week, and not surprisingly, my hero is Jamie Johnson, and so I'd like to tell you why. Nothing is more dangerous than bringing transparency to the issues of privileges in a society, and not just our society, any society. For some reason, we as human beings are desperately stuck on our privileges. We're very clear to point out other people's privileges, but it's very hard to look in the mirror and see our own. And the sort of the wasp's nest that you can step in from that is one that I personally relate to a lot, given some of the things that have happened to me when I worked in the Bush administration and in Washington. This conversation is particularly sensitive now since the adoption of GATT and the WTO. I've encouraged you many times to watch the video of Sir James Goldsmith talking about the fundamental shift in the value of capital and labor globally. But we are engineering a fundamental shift. Some of it is new technology. Some of it is simply rebalancing globally. And, of course, some of it is planned. And much of this shift has been engineered with government and finance with government debt. And as the bubbles slow, as I said before, serious questions are emerging about whether this shift is being engineered in a way that makes fundamental economic sense, let alone the cultural and spiritual ramifications. So it's a very important question. It's going on everywhere. No matter where you live, no matter where you are, this is a question that's or a dynamic that's happening and causing accelerating change. It takes a lot of courage to look at these issues, let alone to get us to open up and talk about them. And Jamie did so in both of his films, and he did so in a way with kind of a state of amusement and a human kindness that I think is very special. So I was delighted that he could join us this evening. And Jamie, are you with us? Welcome from the East Coast. Start us out. Your first documentary, Jamie, was Born Rich. Start us out and tell us how the idea came about. How did it happen that you decided to make a film?
Well, the first film I made was called Born Rich, and that film was about 10 children who were, or young adults who were born to wealth. And when I decided to make the film, I was in college at the time, and I myself was about to inherit some family money. And I was looking around, and I noticed a number of people who were in my position, who had everything going for them, who had great education and all of these opportunities to have amazing and interesting lives. Many of them were miserable, and many of them didn't live interesting lives in spite of the great opportunities and privileges that they had. And I thought, what a strange paradox. You know, you have this group of people, this very fortunate minority who has all of this access and can make all of these choices and have the opportunities to improve their lives, and yet they don't seem to have lived successful lives. So I wanted to explore that on film, and that was what the result of that was, this film called Born Rich.
And what did you learn making it, including the, what did you learn that you never expected to learn?
Well, you know, one thing I didn't fully understand was the degree to which identity is tied to wealth for people who have great deals of money. And you know, it's something that it seems like a minor point when you're talking about wealth, but I really don't think it is. I think that people who have money, and especially family money or money for generations, it becomes such a part of who they think they are, and they're so deeply attached to it as a sense of their own identity, and they really don't build meaning in their lives in other areas. So the only thing that becomes meaningful to them is the money, and in the absence of that, you look at their lives and you see that they aren't really developed in other ways. And I think that it's why some of those stereotypes exist, where you look at people born to wealth and you say, oh, well, there's snobbery there and there's entitlement there. And I think that largely goes back to the fact that people stay in a very narrow framework in a comfort zone, and that comfort zone relates to the security they have when they're around people who respond to them based on the money that they've inherited.
One of the things that comes out early on is you're kind of saying, well, why is there such a taboo about talking about money? And I think my impression from watching you in Born Rich is you kind of don't. You're quizzical. Why is there such a taboo? Why is this such an uncomfortable topic for everybody? Why can't we talk about this? I want to talk about
it. You know, it's still a little bit unclear to me, but it's another funny point. You know, for people that value wealth above everything else, then don't want to talk about money is an absurd contradiction. Money is everything in their lives, yet they don't want to talk about it directly. And I think in large part it has to do with the fact that if you start to talk about someone's, you know, compare power. One person's power over another, or one individual's wealth over another's, it starts to raise questions about their right to possess that wealth. And I don't think that's a conversation that many people with money want to have, because I think it makes them feel vulnerable. If you start to talk about their wealth, then they feel like somehow they might have to defend it. And if they have to defend it, that means that there might be an opportunity, or they might be in a position to lose that wealth.
Well, but I found this taboo and this discomfort everywhere in society. So in 1999, I worked in New York and then Washington, and I moved to a little farming town in Tennessee, Hickory Valley, Tennessee. And about a year later, one of the activist groups got the USDA database of everybody who got farming subsidies, and they put it up on the internet. And so you could see, by county, who got how much money over the last 5 years. Well, the farmers went nuts. You would have thought, that you put photos of them naked up on the internet or something. It was quite funny. But I think the discomfort about talking about our money is not just among the wealthy, it's among everybody. It's on Wall Street, we used to have, you would have two traders sitting next to each other on the trading floor of Dillon Reed, and they would share the most amazing things, including women, but they wouldn't tell each other how much each other made, ever.
Yeah, and perhaps there is a sense, that also relates to a sense of vulnerability. To tell somebody how much you make is, in a way, putting a value on what you do, and or on a value on everything about you. And I think people feel nervous that they might find themselves to be less valued than others. And I don't think people want to put themselves or find themselves in that position. So it's interesting.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, you see it with politicians a lot too. Wealthy politicians, more than anyone else, seem to avoid making their wealth known publicly. And I think that they feel that it's not as though they give up that wealth. If they didn't want to be, it would be very easy for them to say, okay, well, I'm no longer going to be rich. I'm going to disperse or distribute or give away all of these assets that make me wealthy. But they don't want to do that because they know that their wealth is tied to power. And at the same time, they don't want to be perceived as wealthy because they're worried that that might make them look undesirable as candidates somehow to voters.
And in fact, you found one heir who you interviewed in the 1% who had given away his wealth.
I did. Yeah. His name is Chuck Collins, and he was an heir to the Oscar Mayer meatpacking fortune. And when he was about to inherit some family money, when he was a young adult, he made the decision to give all of his wealth to charities. And it was a decision, as he describes in my film, that his family was troubled by, and his father specifically didn't support the decision, but he made that choice regardless, and now he's got a family. He's a middle-aged man, and he stands behind the decision he made as a young adult, and seems to be one of the better things, more important things he's ever done in his life.
So you think he's happier as a result?
He seems to be. It seems to have been the right choice for him. He's an activist and a writer, and he spends a lot of time advocating for a more fair economy and political policies that support the middle class. So he's active, and he's told me personally many times that he feels that he's much happier as a result of making that decision.
Now, you ended up in litigation because of the Born Rich. I guess it was while it was being filmed.
The first film I made, yeah, one of the subjects in the film decided after being filmed that he didn't want to he didn't want to be included in the film, and sued me over that.
Well, it's always, I spent 11 years in litigation. I'm the kind of person who will do anything to avoid litigation. So it's quite amazing that I spent time in litigation, but when I saw that, I said, oh, Jamie, I feel so sorry. But we all have to learn this. One of my favorite scenes in Born Rich is when you're when you're in the map store and you point out that there are no college courses on how to be a productive rich person. You've got to, you know, you're kind of figuring out how to invent your own world. And I thought you might want to comment on that because I thought that was a remarkable scene.
Well, yeah, I mean, rich people are not raised to be responsible wealth holders. I mean, I think more and more they are, and I think times have changed since I made that film. You know, it was roughly 8 years ago, and I think affluent families and family offices and even banks that cater to high net worth clients are now creating education programs and resources to help educate heirs to wealth about ways to be responsible with their family money. But at the time, there was less of it. And I think, you know, you definitely see the result of that. I mean, you see so many people who have a lot of influence because of their family money who really don't handle that position very well. And I don't want to be excessively critical, but you know, I think the notion of kind of reckless and out of control rich kids is you know, there's something behind that perception. There's some truth behind it.
We had Jay Hughes on the Solari Report a while back, and his book Family Wealth talks about that. And you've got him, I think, in one or both, I can't remember which one it is. I think it's Born Rich, talking about the dangers of wealth and a family going back to poverty in a couple generations.
Yeah, Jay's an interesting guy. I interviewed him for 1% actually, but you know, I know him through my own family's you know, has engaged him for help with some of the things they've been doing with their family office, and also just as an author and someone who's out there in the community speaking about this subject. And he's a really thoughtful guy, and he's served so many really wealthy families and seen how wealth can be problematic for people who really aren't prepared to.
Well, I kept trying to get all the subscribers to read Family Wealth because, you know, I kept saying, Jay, I know you wrote this for wealthy families, but I think people who would like to be wealthy can learn an awful lot from it as well. So, because it's a lot about building up a group, you know, how a group of people build each other up and then really do build wealth over a long period of time.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of good and practical advice there for people who are trying to strengthen families and build their family offices and family wealth also, yeah.
Let's go to the 1%, because in Born Rich, you kind of talk to your family and your friends, but in 1%, you really branch out and you reach out to you got a lot of great interviews. But maybe you could talk about how 1% came to happen. Because I was imagining after Born Rich that you'd be struggling through all the feedback, positive and negative, and so you might be gun-shy to do another one.
You know, I was more excited by the challenge of engaging people about talking about wealth that really didn't want to speak about it at the time than I am even now. So when I finished Born Rich, even though there was controversy surrounding the film, and people were reluctant to go on camera to speak about their own money, I really liked the challenge of trying to get them to talk about it, and in some cases almost force them to talk about it. It's coming off of Born Rich. Coming off. Hello? You good?
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Coming off of Born Rich, Coming off of Born Rich, the 1% seemed like the next logical step in terms of filmmaking. It seemed like I, you know, really many things were happening politically at the time that were, in my opinion, working directly against the problem of the growing wealth gap in America, and it didn't seem like many people with wealth were addressing that problem, or even willing to acknowledge it. So I thought that it was the right time to make a film about the growing wealth gap in America and to force rich people to speak to that issue.
One of my favorite parts was the sugar mogul. I was wondering if you could describe that for the people who haven't seen it yet.
Sure. Well, there's a family in Florida called the Von Hool family, and they grow sugar cane, and in an area west of Palm Beach in the Florida Everglades, and it's a very controversial business for a number of reasons, because there are environmental consequences to farming sugar, and there's also a price support system in place for sugar that is instituted by the government. So the environmental and political issues cause a great deal of controversy for this family, and it's something that I covered in the film.
One of the reasons I really like the sugar mogul part is I don't think the issue is wealth versus not wealth. It's, you know, I think the issue is, are we going to build our wealth from doing things that make the pie bigger? Are we going to build our wealth from things that make the pie shrink? And I think the sugar mogul story really brought out that issue, because government money is so often, or enforcement, is so often part of engineering things that make absolutely no economic sense. And they build somebody a fortune, but it's, you know, it can be devastating for the economy. And I think if there's, America's always had a tradition of finding wealth's fine if you make it through innovation. So no, I've never heard anybody criticize Steve Jobs for being too rich. You know, but it's instead when you get rich by doing something that sort of shrinks the pie, is I think what the argument is. And so to me the frame is not between the have and have nots. It's from the people who make money from doing something that's productive and people who make money from doing something which is overall harmful. And I think the sugar mogul story really popped the balloon of we're making money because we're doing something useful.
Indeed, yeah. I think there are responsible ways to build wealth and irresponsible ways to build wealth. And I think I tend to agree with you. You know, I definitely support responsible ways to make a lot of money. In this instance, the issue you're describing with the sugar moguls, without... Without some of the price supports that are in place, that were put in place by the U.S. government, the sugar industry in the U.S. really wouldn't exist, and so therefore it doesn't necessarily align with the fundamental principles of capitalism. But yet people are getting rich
right
off it. So it's a tricky one.
It came out in Born Rich, but it really came out in the 1%, and I was really glad to see it, was how much fear, you know, many of the people I know think fear is something that we feel in the middle class or the lower class, but they don't appreciate how much fear there is all the way up into the most wealthy. And so you watch children, you know, you explored how were people worried about losing their fortunes or getting disowned. Or the fear of punishment of saying something that would be offensive. And you realized, you know, there's an awful lot of fear among the wealthy.
A lot of fear, yeah. I think people are very nervous that they might lose their place in the Byzantine order of society. And I think that a lot of their social relationships reinforce their financial status, and people really don't want to lose any position financially. So there's a lot of fear in the community, and many people are more desperately trying to hang on than outsiders might assume.
But you don't feel any fear. I've watched both movies, and I've never seen an ounce of fear in you.
I think that also a lot of people's fears stem from the fact that they're really not honest with themselves. I mean, going back to the fear of speaking about money, people will tell you that it's in bad taste to talk about money, or that you shouldn't talk about money. And at the same time, money means everything to them. And it's just a lack of self-awareness, and it's really a resistance to acknowledge your own personal priorities about wealth. And I think when people are willing to be more responsible in that way and are really willing to say, hey, this is what I care about in life and I can stand behind it, then they're not as fearful. And, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with saying money is important to me. But I do think that problems arise when people house internal contradictions. For example, when they say, oh, it's impolite to talk about money, you should never talk about money, yet money means absolutely everything to them, and it's, you know, all they think about all day, every day. So I feel like, you know, I'm not that fearful because I have a clear sense of what I value in my own life and what's important to me, and I try and stay in touch with that.
Yeah, you kind of have a feeling you could drop you off in the middle of Afghanistan without any money or credit card, and you'd make it back. I thought that was, that definitely came through. Well, now we have to go to Milton Friedman, because I have to tell you that was one of my favorite parts of the 1%. How in the world did you end up interviewing Milton Friedman?
I wrote Milton Friedman a letter, and he responded. He just, you know, I received a letter back from him. I didn't anticipate that he would respond, but he did fairly promptly. Mm-hmm. And the letter just said, "I'm out in San Francisco. Come out and if you're in the area, you can interview me." The interview ended up taking place at his apartment. I wasn't sure based on the address that he had sent me, and I had coordinated with his assistant at the time. And I ended up just showing up as his apartment. And, you know, he brought me right into his office, and that's where we taped it.
I was amazed. Were you amazed that he got up and walked out?
I was amazed at that, you know, and it was a different time, you know, since the financial collapse. The recent financial collapse, people have been reevaluating Milton Friedman's principles and some of his scholarship. It's not quite as popular to support it enthusiastically in the way that it was before 2008. He had a different level of confidence in public perception about the free market's ability to solve all social problems. Was different at the time, and I don't think many people were probably that interviewed him were probably challenging him maybe in the same way that I was, but he certainly got pissed to say it frankly and tore off his mic and walked and stood up and walked right out of the room. It was in his own house, so I mean he didn't go far, but he walked away.
I can just imagine you turning to the guy with the camera and saying, "Did you get that in the can?" That was pretty choice. And you interviewed, you had a lot of good interviews in the 1%. I love the fact that you had Phillips in there. I thought that was an incredible interview.
Yeah,
you remember,
was great.
Kevin Phillips, he talked about the recklessness of what we were doing. And you had Wright and Ralph Nader and... just a lot of really a lot of rich interviews. And, you know, a lot of times when we talk about the policy issues on this, it can be pretty boring. But you kept it very, you must not have been an economics major in college.
I'm certainly not that knowledgeable in that area. I was definitely not an economics major in college. And one of the things that I was worried about and was a constant challenge while making a movie was how to make the subject come to life. It can be a boring topic to address problems with the economy and socioeconomic problems. So to try and interview people and make those interviews entertaining and to a television audience was something that I was always trying to consider.
Well, I think one of the reasons it worked is because, we're kind of going along in your journey and you're trying to figure out, why is this happening? Why is this happening? Why is this happening? And you can't figure it out, and so the audience doesn't feel stupid because they can't figure it out either. And they're kind of wandering with you on the journey.
To add to that point, one of the things that I found astounding was I would say to the smartest people in the world, people who, Nobel laureates, people who have studied this topic and read about it and written about it for their entire lives and done so brilliantly, and said, hey, if you were in my position, if you were extremely wealthy or, in a real position to initiate change here, what would you do? And they would say, well, hey, I would make a film. I'd do what you're doing. And I would say, well, I'm already doing that. What else would you do? And, none of them had a clear answer. And, whether it was Robert Reich or Milton Friedman or Ralph Nader or Kevin Phillips, all of them would respond, and they would come up with a sweeping response. It was, really full of generalities. And I kept saying, well, can you give me one first step, or one clear step? And it's such a messy social problem, the problem of growing inequality in the country, or even building wealth responsibly. It's something that's so confusing for people that not even
right.
These extremely brilliant figures could respond concisely and even fully coherently.
Well, but also they're used to functioning at a policy level, not an entrepreneurial level. So, an entrepreneur says, okay, you have 3 hours this week, you can do this, this, and sequences it. At a policy level, you talk about, okay, government changes these tax policies. So the question is, the interesting thing about both Born Rich, but even more so 1%, you're going back and forth between micro and macro. But when you talk to those guys, generally they're used to functioning at macro, not micro. And you're saying, okay, what can I do at micro? And
if no one has an answer at
right.
the micro level, then, that's a big part of the problem. Oh, well, as you were saying, I certainly didn't have great solutions there. I was trying to figure it out for myself, and that was, the journey of the film. But then when the smartest people around couldn't tell me anything much better, that was, that was revealing.
Well, actually, I think when a lot of people start to shift their behavior, whether it's your actions or your transactions or your attention, we have the power to shift a huge amount of this with our personal actions. And that's why I think that I focus a lot on transparency, and that's why I loved your films, because, you can't change the consciousness, let alone get to action or transaction, without illuminating what in the world is happening and what can we do about it. It's, I have to read this quote, I'm sure you know it. It's, it was right at the end when you're talking about your dad, and you said, it's wonderful. Your dad was talking about it's not possible to change the world, only to touch a few lives. And you said, but if you're always hiding from the problem, you're never going to find any solutions. So I do think there's an incredible amount that every individual can do simply, but that starts by kind of, because the more of us who do it together, the better. I have a friend who ran for governor in Tennessee, he said, you know, you think a snowflake is powerless until you realize enough of them can get together and they can shut down New York City.
Right. Yeah.
So micro action to me is powerful. I wanted to ask you, have you ever seen the movie Syriana that George Clooney made about the Middle East?
I have. Yeah, I did see it when it was when it first came out, yeah.
Okay, because every time I would see your dad get upset with you, which was a couple times, I would think of the you know, the Middle Eastern prince who turned to Matt Damon, who's playing the investment banker from Switzerland, and screams at him, you know, as long as I spend lots of money and live a wonderful and luxurious life, I'm fine. But if I start to invest money locally to build up the strength of my people, you know, I'll offend the powers that be. And what he was saying, one of the expressions I used, do you know what the third rail is in the subway system? There's two tracks. The train runs on the two tracks, and then the third, there's a little gizmo that flaps over onto this third rail, and that's where the power lies. And so what's funny is we have this, I call it the central banking warfare model, but we have this economic model, and it's very centralized and it's very controlled. And no one from the very poor to the very wealthy feels free to kind of touch the third rail and re-engineer it for fear that they're going to offend. So here you have this guy that Matt Damon is the investment banker, thinks is very wealthy and very powerful, but what he's saying is, you know, I have to function within the model. And so when I saw your dad, I said, your dad is frustrated because he's dealing with the, you know, he understands the dangers of touching the third rail. And that's when I looked at you and I said, this guy is fearless. This is fabulous. But, you know, the question is, we're all afraid. And I do think that there are real dangers because people, you know, there have been many people who've tried to touch the third rail, including very wealthy people. And, you know, and they regret doing it. It was very dangerous, and including they lost their lives. So I always wanted to ask you whether you watched, you'd watched Syriana or not, and whether you related to that scene.
I'll have to watch it. Yeah, I'll have to watch it again with that comparison in mind. And, you know, I think it's a good point. My father, in his own life, I think when he did resist certain authorities and kind of challenged the establishment, for lack of a better way of describing it, I think when he was a younger man, he was criticized for it, and he mentions that to me in the film The 1%, and he kind of says exactly what you were reiterating. You know, if I make those kinds of decisions in life and I try and initiate change, that could backfire for a number of people, and people would be very angry with me for it. And I can appreciate that, and it's very easy for me to appreciate that, for one, because I obviously love my father, and I can kind of see the truth in this statement. And also, I feel like he, in his own indirect way, is supportive of my efforts, and I think he feels that on some level it's kind of interesting that I'm able to take certain risks that didn't always work out for him when he was a young man, and where people...
One of the things that comes out tremendously is you just see it's just written all over his face how much he loves you and how proud he is of you. And that's one of the things I think that makes the film so human and so touching, that you would share that with us. So
yeah,
it's quite wonderful.
Add a human element to the... Right.
Now, you came... This you published this in 2000, the 1%, 2007 or 2008?
Well, I had screened the film at a film festival in 2006, and then HBO purchased the film and asked me to re-edit some things, and then they ultimately aired it for the first time in early 2008.
So it came out before the big drop in the markets and the bailouts, or
it did
right at
yes.
the same time. So your timing was extraordinary.
It was definitely, you know, I think probably more people would have seen the film, obviously, had the film come out after everything had happened. And you know, when the film came out, people were still, conservatives really weren't willing to say yet that the market can't solve all of society's problems. If you just, with less regulation, you know, everything's going to work out fine. And I feel like there are very, very few people who are saying that today. I mean, even conservatives are saying, well, of course, yes, you need oversight. And that's really not exactly, that wasn't a, it was very popular to say that any oversight at all was a horrible idea before the financial collapse. So that's something that's changed.
It's a very different perspective watching it than today than it would have been then. Now, what was your feedback on the 1%? What for the year following that? What was the feedback to you?
Well, and interestingly, you know, to answer that question, many people would say one of their biggest problems with a film was, well, nothing's going to happen. You know, you're creating a sense of urgency with a film, but there's really no sense that there's any protest out there in society, or there's no unrest over this issue. Yeah, you know, maybe they ran a series on inequality in the New York Times, but that's hardly a real conflict over this issue. And now you're seeing, with Occupy Wall Street, you're seeing something happen that everyone thought would never occur.
Mm. Critics, well, I would have thought. Yeah. I know. We have a question. We have questions coming in on the webinar. Let me just ask you one. I think Occupy Wall Street is proof that America, indeed, the world is having the conversation about inequality. But that conversation is not and never will be between the have and the have-nots. This country needs jobs and not ones that pay Indonesian wages, but they seem to be where the 1% want to take us. That's where they sent the jobs, in search of more short-term profits for lining executive pockets. You and Buffett should team up to try and change their minds. Ours are already decided in favor of change, and we have no power within the current system to affect change. We have taxation without representation, with Congress, of course, and the entire monetary and military security structures controlled by the top 1%. Just exactly what are we supposed to do to start change, to change the system to make it more fair to those in the bottom 99% by growing our own food? I feel the situation is hopeless.
Well, it's certainly, yeah. I mean, it's a discouraging moment in history. At the same time, I probably my outlook isn't as bleak. My personal take on the situation, but yeah, I think, you know, there are, well, you just referenced many things, but I think people have a right to be pissed off about what's happening in the country right now, and I think they are, and I think Occupy Wall Street is a real example of that, and now that dissatisfaction has a voice. It may not be as concise or as clear as it could be, but certainly you're seeing frustration.
Have you been to or watched or seen any of the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations?
I've been down there, yeah. I've been down to the center of the movement and the protests, and to me it looked like two groups of people. You know, it looked like there were some highly motivated community activists there, and it looked like there were other people who were hanging out and kind of on the periphery of the activism, but enjoying the momentum of crowds gathering and kind of the spirit of the movement, but perhaps weren't so engaged in actually really an agenda of any kind.
We have another comment. It's funny. It's somebody says, that's funny. I'm always scared to talk about my little financial wealth out of fear of somebody taking it. So, okay. So here's the thing. I know you must get a lot of pressure, and I hate to pressure you, but I think you have an incredible gift. Are there films in the future?
There are films in the future. Sure, there are. You know, I'm not. I are there going to be more films about wealth and inequality? I mean, I'm sure there will be. On some level, it's very hard for me not to think about the topic. At the same time, you know, I started working on a documentary that's about something very different. It relates to wealth, but it's really about the declining influence of the Protestant establishment. So I wouldn't say that it has anything to do with what's happening with Occupy Wall Street or the protests or the growing wealth gap. It's really about a shift in power within the upper class and how that's changed over the last two or three generations in this country.
Well, I think you have a sort of a fearless gift of taking the long view and asking great questions. Do you know what a trim tab is?
I don't.
It's both on an airplane and an aircraft carrier or a big ship. The way you turn the rudder is the rudder has a rudder called the trim tab. And we used to say, when I was in Washington, we did a lot of government reengineering. We used to say there are two ways to turn an aircraft carrier. You can talk to the captain, or you can just put on a wetsuit, go down, and start blowing bubbles on the trim tab. And when I watch Born Rich and the 1%, you have a way of sort of getting in a situation and getting some perspective on it. You know, you kind of can see it top down and going right to the trim tab. What's the thing we can change here that could shift this? You know, and so you have a way of going at it. And I think that's a gift that can apply to anything you get interested in. You know, whether it has to do with wealth or, you know, it has to do with the relationship between people. So I think that, you know, my take watching the, because I'm a person who's had a lot of experience at all levels of society. I've been rich, I've been poor, you know, and I have a very wide scope. And I think the themes you're talking about just cross-cut very, very broadly, not just in America, but globally. So it's a very human discussion and debate that has very wide-ranging ramifications. So. Now, the important thing for everybody listening to this is, as you can tell, I'm trying to get them to watch Born Rich and the 1%. How do we stay in touch with you and your work? If we want to follow Jamie Johnson, how do we do it?
Well, certainly films are out there. They're accessible through Netflix and Hulu and other easily accessible platforms on the internet. You can watch them right on your computer if you have access to Netflix. And I think those are, for now, that's certainly the easiest way to see those films. And in the future, I'd say they'll probably be in the very same places over the years. I can't be 100% sure, but I would imagine.
And you blog on Vanity Fair?
I did. I wrote a weekly column for Vanity Fair for a few years, and that was a blast. And now actually looking forward to writing some more long form stories for different publications. But so actually trying to go a little deeper with some of the writing and reporting I've been doing on the topic.
Okay.
So that's another place where
I
might have some stuff coming out.
Okay. Well, when you start to publish, put me on your list because I would love to republish your stuff and point people to it from the blog.
Great.
Jamie, I really want to thank you. I think your work has made an incredible contribution, and it's certainly given me an enormous amount of delight. And I want to thank you for taking the time to join us on the Solari Report, and you just have a wonderful evening.
Yeah, thank you so much. And let me just say that many people in your position aren't as receptive to these ideas as you are. So I really appreciate it that you took the time and found something interesting about the material. So thank you so much.
Have a great night.
You too.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I wanted to mention, again, we have comment capacity on the blog. When you come into the blog, if you log in, you'll be able to post your questions. We've turned off the cart question capacity. You can still email them in, but please feel free to post them on the blog, and then others, after they log in, can see them as well. We're also planning on having a transcript up from every Solari report and so of the interview. And so the transcript for Jamie's interview will be up next Wednesday. We've posted the transcript from last week's Precious Metals Market Report, and also from the third quarter review if you didn't get a chance to hear those. We're also, when you come in and log into the blog, we're making sure that the MP3 file gets segmented, so by Friday or Monday, you'll be able to see the outline, and then you can dive in and listen to the parts that are of the most interest to you. And we're trying to make it possible so that the information is much more accessible, much faster. You can listen selectively. You don't have to listen to the whole thing, and so you can jump around much more easily. November 3rd, coming up, John Patrick Shanley, Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, exciting new play on sort of some of the issues we were talking with Jamie Johnson about tonight. November 10th, back on the Precious Metals Market Report. I'll be in California, not Tennessee, but Franklin and I are being joined by Edwin Vieira, who is the author of Pieces of Eight, the premier constitutional scholar and attorney in the country on the issues related to silver and legal issues related to silver and gold. And I want to talk with him a little bit more about the how we transition at a local level to using silver and gold as a currency if inflation really does continue to kick up, particularly after the election. And then on November 17th, William Tiller from Stanford University, very important research on intention and the ability of our thoughts to impact sort of energetic reality, which comes back and impacts material reality. I'll say it that way. I'm sure as a scientist he would say it differently. But for those of you who understand the importance of the field or interested in the importance of the field and consciousness, I think it's a very interesting. If you do a search on the blog, I posted several weeks ago some material from Tiller and some very important papers and a video discussion. So a very interesting and exciting lineup. And so until next week, until it's not next week. Next week, in fact, let me mention, on Thursday I'll be speaking at the Mill Valley Community Center in Mill Valley in the Bay Area. And my topic will be investment strategies for changing times. We're going to make a video which will be accessible through the Solari Report for all subscribers, and we hope to have that up by November 11th. If you can't be in Mill Valley on October 27th, next Thursday, you'll certainly be able to watch the video through the website. So again, that's it for this evening. Please remember, until we meet again on November 3rd, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.